blessed thing. As many people as there are to hold you back, there are angels whose humanity makes up for all the others. I've had my share of angels. Popsy was one of those. Popsy made Deepak chief resident overnight, but with the proviso that he be chief resident for 2 years. Deepak was in his last year of training when I arrived. So you will be done the same day I finish my internship? His silence made me anxious. Slowly, he shook his head. We got notice today of a site visit soon from the people who accredit our residency training program. If they don't like what they see, they can shut us down. We've got too few interns, and too few resident physicians at every level for the patient volume we handle, not to mention too few faculty. How did this happen? Our competition is sweetening the pot. We were lucky to get you and Nestor and Rahul. We need more interns, more full-time faculty. Popsy just isn't as influential as he once was to attract good faculty. At this point, it's only Popsy's credentials and academic history that gives our program accreditation. On paper, Popsy is golden. If Popsy steps down, or word gets out that he has early dementia, the House of Cards falls. I must have looked concerned because he said, "Don't worry. You'll be able to find another slot and get credit for this year." Is that what it is about? The bailiff serving you papers? Oh, that's my so-called wife. Now she thinks I must be making a lot of money, so she is filing in New York for spousal support. I have a lawyer who tells me that I have nothing to worry about. I owe her nothing. What about you, Deepak? What will you do if this place closes? I don't know, Marion. I can't go through this again. Can't keep assisting someone who is my senior but is butchering the case and doesn't have the sense to ask me to help. Maybe I'll just keep on working here. Sister Magda says the hospital will employ me. I'll live here, just like Popsy lives here. I'll operate. The hospital doesn't care if I am board certified or not, particularly if the residency program closes. Our lady needs a surgeon. I'll be another Popsy. Believe it or not, Popsy, till his breakdown, was a super surgeon, Deepak said. What's more important, he was a fine man, truly colorblind. After Mr. Walter's surgery, Deepak had spread the word that Popsy was not to operate anymore at any cost. Is there anything we can do to keep them from shutting us down? I asked Deepak. Pray, he said. Chapter 42 Bloodlines. I prayed, but it didn't help. With 2 months to go to finish my internship and for Deepak to finish his chief residency, our program was placed on probation. I worried about my fate. It was bad enough that we might be closed down, but it would be worse not to get credit for the year I'd put in. I felt terrible for Deepak, who had come so close to finishing his chief resident year. Until our appeal was heard, though, and the final order came to shut us down, there was little to do but plod on. On a Friday evening, I was summoned to the trauma room, and I reached there just as the ambulance rode in. The crew slid out a stretcher, snapped its wheels down, then raced in with it as if it were a battering ram. The glass doors parted just in time. I thought of these things as minor miracles, everyday efficiencies that were such a contrast to what I'd known in Africa. I jogged alongside. After almost a year at Our Lady, I'd done this many times, but the adrenaline still surged. "John Doe, MVA, barely breathing at the scene," one of the men pushing the stretcher said. "Ran a red light, got broadsided by a van on the driver's side, no seatbelt, went airborne through windshield. Then, if you can believe this, his own car, spinning around, slammed into his body. Flyball to center field, kid you not. Eyewitnesses. He landed on the pavement. No obvious neck injuries, left ankle shattered, bruises on chest and belly." I saw a handsome black male, clean cut and no older than 20. The ambulance crew had 2 bags of intravenous saline going wide open. They had drawn blood, and now they handed over the red, blue, and lavender-topped tubes to the lab technician, who would begin typing and cross-matching for blood before we'd even cut off the patient's clothes. "There's more to this," the ambulance driver said. The reason he ran the red light is because he was in a gunfight with gangbangers. One of them got shot in the head. An ambulance is on its way with that guy. Don't worry, it ain't no emergency. They had to scoop parts of his brain off the sidewalk. Kindergarten through fifth grade from the looks of it. This guy, he said, pointing to our patient, did the shooting. Our patient's skull was intact, but he was unconscious. The part buzzed into his short hair was as straight as if it had been applied with a ruler. It was one of the strange things one noticed at such times. His pupils constricted briskly to the light I shone at them, a crude but reassuring sign that his brain was all right. His pulse was thready and racing under my fingers. The monitor read 160 beats a minute. A nurse called out the pressure.
80 over nothing.
A few seconds later, she said, 50 over zero. Fluids were pouring in. Blood was on its way. There was a bruise over the lower right ribs. His belly was tense and it seemed to be swelling under my eyes.
No pressure,
the nurse announced, just as the X-ray technician arrived with the portable machine.
No time for this. He's exsanguinating, I said. Let's take him to the operating room. It's his only chance.
Nobody moved.
Now,
I said, giving the stretcher a push.
Call my backup. Let them know.
In the operating room, I scrubbed for just 30 seconds while Dr. Rinaldo, the anesthetist, adjusted the tracheal tube. Rinaldo looked at me and shook his head. I pulled on my gloves while looking at what the scrub nurse had laid out.
Forget sponges. Let's get lap packs. Open them out. We won't have time to unfold them. There is going to be so much blood. We'll need big basins to hold the clots.
The patient's belly was more tense than it had been downstairs. Rinaldo, peering crocodile-like above his mask, shrugged when I looked at him for the signal to start.
Get ready, I said to Rinaldo, 'cause when I open, the pressure is going to bottom out.
What pressure? Rinaldo said.
No pressure.
For now, the blood expanding the belly was serving as a compress, tamping off the bleeding vessel wherever it was. But the moment I opened the belly, the geyser would open again. I layered pads all around. I poured betadine over the skin, swabbed it off, said a prayer, and cut. Blood welled out, spilled over the edge of the wound like a storm surge. Despite all the pads, despite my suction hose sucking greedily, the blood lapped over the drapes, onto the table, and splashed to the floor. I felt it soak through my gown, felt it on my thighs, in my socks, my feet squishing in my shoes.
More packs!
I tried to warn the nurses, but we were still unprepared for the torrent. I reached in with my hand, displacing a second wave of blood as I grabbed the small bowl. With two hands now, I pulled loops out, fed them onto a towel by the side of the incision. In seconds, I had effectively disemboweled the patient. Deepak appeared across from me, scrubbed and ready. I clasped my hands together, stepped back to cross to the other side of the table, but he shook his head.
Stay there, he said.
He grabbed a retractor and pulled so I could see under the diaphragm. I stuffed the lap packs all around the liver. Then I did the same on the left side, in the vicinity of the spleen. With cupped fingers, I scooped out the big clots that remained in the abdominal cavity. I jammed more packs all over the abdomen and into the pelvis, until everything was wedged tight. No blood vessel was pumping that I could see. We could stop and take a breath.
Are we catching up on blood?
I asked Rinaldo.
We never catch up, he said.
When I kept staring at him, he shrugged. He nodded at his dials as if to say things were no worse than when we began. That's what I hoped he had said. Now I carefully removed the packs, starting with the spots where the bleeder was least likely to be. The pelvis was clean, no gusher there. Off came the pack around the spleen. If the patient's belly was a room, the furniture, the most movable central structures, had been pulled out so we had a good view to the rear. If there was a bleed from a torn aorta or its branches, then this back wall of the abdomen, the retroperitoneum, would have shown a big, ugly swelling, a hematoma. But that was clean, too. I had a premonition that we would find the bleeder behind the liver.
a place full of shadows, hard to see or fix. This was where the inferior vena cava, the largest vein in the body, carried blood back from the lower limbs and trunk, running through and behind the liver on its way to the heart. While coursing through the liver, it picked up the stumpy, taut hepatic veins that drained that organ. I took the pack away from the liver. Nothing. I gently pulled the liver forward to look at its dark side. An angry gush of blood filled the empty bowl of the abdomen. I hastily pushed the liver back, and the pumping ceased. Things were all right as long as we didn't touch the liver. What was it that Solomon, operating in the bush, had called this? The injury in which the surgeon sees God. Okay, Deepak said. Let's leave it like that. What now? He's oozing from the skin incision and from all the IV sites. His blood isn't clotting. Deepak had a soft voice, and I had to lean over to hear him. It's inevitable with this much trauma. We open them up, pour fluids into them, and the body temperature drops. We have diluted the clotting system so it stops working. Let's pack around the liver and get out. Put him in ICU where we can warm him up, give him more fresh frozen plasma and blood. In a couple of hours, if he's alive, if he is more stable, we can come back. I sandbagged the liver and fed the small bowel back into the wound. Instead of suturing the skin, we used towel clips to hold the wound edges together. The transplant teams will be here to harvest the corneas, heart, lungs, liver, and kidneys from the man he shot, Deepak said. This theater is bigger, and I'll let them have it. In the intensive care unit, 2 hours later, the oozing from the puncture wound ceased. The cluster of poles and machinery around the bed made it tricky to get near Shane Johnson Jr. That was his name. His family was in the waiting room, trying to fathom the unfathomable. Fresh frozen plasma, warmed blood, and fluids had given Junior a recordable blood pressure and a respectable temperature. He was alive, but just barely. Okay, Deepak said, after reassessing the patient and looking at the clock. Let's go take another look. This time we were in the smaller operating room. Ronaldo was still all gloom. Junior's face and limbs were puffy, his capillaries leaking out what was being poured into him. But we still had to pour fluid in to keep a blood pressure. It was like keeping a bucket full despite the holes in its side. Deepak insisted that I be on the patient's right again. It took just seconds to remove the drapes, swab his skin, and pop open the towel clips that held the skin edges together. I removed the packs. Deepak guided my fingers to the stock of vessels that led into the liver. Okay, he said. Squeeze there. This was the Pringle maneuver. I squeezed, choking off the blood supply to the liver, while Deepak removed the last pad and lifted the liver forward. Blood gushed out at once, turning the dry, clean field into a sopping red mess. Okay, you can let go, he said, pushing the liver back. That's what I was afraid of. The vena cava is torn for sure. That's why, even with the Pringle maneuver, it still bleeds. In some people, the inferior vena cava barely indents the back of the liver. In our patient, the vena cava was swathed by liver like a pig in a blanket. When Junior went airborne, then hit the pavement, his liver kept traveling. Its momentum tore the short veins that anchored it to the vena cava, leaving a jagged rent. Deepak asked for a suture on a long needle holder. At his signal, I pulled the liver forward, and he tried to put the needle in one end of the tear. But before he could even see it, the field was awash with blood. God, I said, violating a cardinal rule about keeping quiet when assisting. How do we fix this? Deepak said, Oh, it's easy to repair the cava. It's just that the liver is in the way. It took me a second to realize that this was as close as Deepak came to joking during surgery. He was silent for a good while, almost in a trance, and I tried not to make a sound. At last, like a priest finishing a prayer, he moved. Okay, he said. It's a long shot. Let's switch sides. I was unprepared for what followed. All I could do was marvel and be the best second pair of hands that I could be. Deepak swabbed Junior's chest, then cut vertically down over the breastbone from top to bottom, then ran an electric saw in the same groove. The smell of burning flesh and bone hung in the air. Suddenly, the chest popped open like an overstuffed suitcase. I didn't ask what he was doing. He didn't explain. My exposure to chest surgery had consisted mostly of draining fluid collections outside the lung or, rarely, watching Deepak resect a cancerous lobe. 3 times during my internship, we had cracked the chest and oversewn a stab injury to the heart. 1 of the 3 survived. This was one of the deficits in our program, one of the reasons we were being shut down. We had to ship off much of the thoracic surgery, not to mention much of the urology and plastic surgery, to other hospitals. Junior's heart, a fleshy, yellow-streaked mass covered by the pericardial sac, was exposed, pumping away as it had done for all his 19 years. It had never been more threatened. Deepak cut open the pericardium. I was aware of activity in the operating room behind me and in the scrub area that was shared. At one point I looked around and through the 3 sets of windows I saw a crowd of white faces around the other operating table. Deepak put a purse-string suture around the right atrium, the upper chamber of the heart that received blood from the vena cava. He took a chest tube and cut side holes in it with scissors. Now he made a nick in the atrium of the heart, in the center of his purse-string suture. Then he slid his newly fashioned tube into the atrium, using the purse-string to cinch the tissue around the tube, which he pushed down through the orifice of the inferior vena cava and down to where our problem was. "Tell me when it reaches the level of the renal veins," he said. I saw the inferior vena cava distend like a garden hose filling with water. "Now," I said. "The tube serves as a stent for the inferior vena cava," Deepak said, leaning over to look from below. "It's also a crude bypass so blood from the trunk can return to the heart while we make the repair. Now, let's see if we can fix this." He adjusted the overhead lights. When I lifted the liver, the bleeding was much less than before, and what's more, the torn edges of the vein were visible on the backdrop of the tube. Deepak grabbed one edge of the tear with long forceps and passed the curved needle through and then grabbed the other edge, passed the needle through that and out, and tied a knot. I let the liver back down. It was a laborious process. Lift, grab, pass needle, mop, pass needle to the other side, mop, tie, relax the pull on liver. At some point, just as we were nearing completion, I sensed someone at my shoulder. Deepak glanced up but did not say anything.
"Is that a Shrokshant, son?" a voice behind me said.
It was a male voice, polite enough, conscious that it was a delicate moment to intrude, but with the authority of one who is entitled to ask. Deepak looked up again, then back to his work.
"Yes, sir," he said.
"How big was the tear?"
Deepak pulled up the liver and adjusted the overhead light so the visitor could see. It was 3/4 of the way around the cava. The tube he'd pushed down from the heart made a lovely internal splint for the vein, and running across it like a crease was the first part of Deepak's neat repair. It was a beautiful sight, order restored from chaos.
"Very impressive," the voice said.
There was no sarcasm, just genuine admiration. I stepped back so the visitor could have a better look, and when I did, he leaned in.
"Very, very nice. I'd put some gel foam around the raw area of the liver. Were you planning to leave some drains?"
"Yes, sir."
"I'm assuming you are the attending physician?"
the voice said. "No, I'm the chief resident. My name is Deepak."
"Where is your attending?"
Deepak met the speaker's eyes and said nothing.
"I see. Not one to get out of bed for this sort of thing. Do you ever see him?"
As if in reply, Rinaldo snorted and turned to his dials, feigning disinterest. The visitor looked to Rinaldo and seemed about to bite his head off, but then, remembering this wasn't his theater, he didn't.
And how many Shrokshunts have you done before, Deepak?
This is my sixth.
Really? In what period of time?
In 2 years here. Unfortunately, we see a lot of trauma.
Unfortunate, yes, but fortunate for us. We are not ungrateful. Still, 6 Shroks, did you say? Remarkable. How have they done?
One died but a week after the surgery. He was walking, eating, probably a pulmonary embolus.
Did you get an autopsy?
Partial. The family allowed us to reopen the belly. The repair to the cava looked good. We took photographs.
And the others?
2nd, 3rd, and 5th are alive and well, 6 months after the operation. 4th died on the table before I got this far. I had just opened the heart.
Do you count that one?
I should. Intention to treat. That counts.
Good man. You should count it. Most surgeons wouldn't. And your 6th?
This is him, Deepak said.
Right. Well, that's better than my experience. I've done 4. That's over 6 years. They all died. 2 on the table, 2 so close after surgery that it was as good as dying on the table. They weren't all trauma like this. 2 were tears from someone trying to remove an adherent cancerous mass. You ought to write up your experience.
Deepak cleared his throat. With all due respect, sir, I have. No one will publish a report from Our Lady.
Nonsense! What is your full name?
Deepak Jesudas, sir. This is my intern.
I tell you what. Write up this case and add him to your series, and then let me take a look at your paper. If it's good, I'll see that it gets published. I'll send it to the editor of the American Journal of Surgery. I'll check with you to see how this patient does. Good luck. By the way, my name is...
I know who you are, sir. Thank you.
The visitor must have been walking away when Deepak said, Sir, if you were to... Never mind.
What is it, man? I have a cadaver organ that I should have in the air by now. I just stopped to admire your work.
If you were to show us how to harvest the liver, we could start it for you, save you time. I tried to turn around to look, but because I was holding a retractor, I couldn't.
I don't trust anyone else to do it, the voice said. That's why I do it myself. My chief residents don't have the skill. Smart boys, but they don't get the volume you have in a place like this.
We get the volume, and they are shutting us down.
What? I had heard some such rumor. I heard Popsy.
True? Deepak just nodded.
This is your 5th year?
The voice said. 7th, 8th, 10th. Depends how you count, sir. He didn't mention his training in England. He didn't need to, because the visitor said,
I hear a Scotch inflection. Were you in Scotland? Took your FRCS?
Yes.
Glasgow?
Edinburgh. I worked in Fife, all over there, Deepak said. There was a profound silence. The man behind me hadn't moved. He seemed to be considering this.
What will you do if they shut down?
Deepak dropped his eyes. I'll keep working. Probably here. I love surgery. After an eternity, the voice said,
Deepak Jesudas, with a J?
And then he spelled it out.
Did I get that right? Come see me in Boston, Dr. Jesudas. We'll pay your fare. I'll arrange for you to come up to my dog lab. We'll get you going. If anyone can harvest for me, you probably can. When you come up, we'll visit at length. Have to run now. Good work, Deepak.
We heard the door swing behind him. We worked in silence. At last, Deepak said. He heard my name just once, and he was able to repeat it. Deepak's repair was done.
He was closing up now, as carefully and efficiently as he had opened. He asked for gel foam from the scrub nurse.
In all my years here, no one's been able to remember my name when I'm introduced. No one has bothered. They usually see us as types, not as individuals.
His shoulders were straighter, his eyes bright and glowing. I'd never seen my chief resident like this. I was happy for him, and proud.
"Who was that?"
I said, at last unable to contain my curiosity.
"Call me old-fashioned," Deepak said, "but I've always believed that hard work pays off. My version of the Beatitudes. Do the right thing, put up with unfairness, selfishness, stay true to yourself. One day it all works out. Of course, I don't know that people who wronged you suffer or get their just deserts. I don't think it works that way. But I do think one day you get your reward."
"Did you know him?" I said again. Deepak sidestepped my question and turned to the circulating nurse.
"Did that particular team come for liver or heart?"
"Liver. Another team took the heart and ran."
Deepak smiled and turned to me. "Marion, I'm not 100% sure because of his mask. Had I seen his fingers, I could have been certain. But I have a pretty good idea. You just met one of the foremost liver surgeons in the world, a pioneer of liver transplants."
"What's his name?"
"Thomas Stone."
Chapter 43. Grand Rounds. I believe in black holes. I believe that as the universe empties into nothingness, past and future will smack together in the last swirl around the drain. I believe this is how Thomas Stone materialized in my life. If that's not the explanation, then I must invoke a disinterested God who leaves us to our own devices, neither causing nor preventing tornadoes or pestilence, but a God who will now and then stick his thumb on the spinning wheel so that a father who put a continent between himself and his sons should find himself in the same room as one of them. As a child, I'd longed for Thomas Stone, or at least the idea of him. So many mornings I waited for him at the gates of missing. I saw that vigil now as necessary, a prerequisite for my insides to harden and cure, just like the willow of a cricket bat must cure to be ready for a lifetime of knocks. That was the lesson at missing's gates. The world does not owe you, and neither does your father. I hadn't forgotten what Ghosh asked of me. Let's just say I'd set it aside. I didn't feel guilty about not following through. I never had time to seek out Thomas Stone, and moreover, wherever he was, I never felt as if I was in his America. I was on an island, a protectorate, a territory that America claimed only in name. In carrying his textbook with me from Addis to Sudan and Kenya and then to America, I had developed a grudging respect for the author. I told myself that the book was my touchstone to Sister Mary Joseph Praise. I saw her hand in the line drawings, and I carried the bookmark with her handwriting in my wallet. I discovered Thomas Stone in the text, just as he must have discovered himself in the discipline of making notes in a landscape of disease and poverty, overcoming his fatigue to fill exercise books with his observations. I was convinced that it was the accumulation of these journals that he pulled together to form a textbook. In doing so, he made his knowledge incarnate. But when that writer, the sole living author of my DNA, stood peering over my shoulder, it was flesh that became incarnate, flesh of my flesh, with a scent that I should have recognized as kin and a voice that was my inheritance. When he leaned over the patient's belly to see our handiwork, cocked his skull on the atlas and axis vertebrae just so, tucked his arms to his chest, his scapulae gliding out, making himself small so as not to contaminate our field. Those movements were echoes of my own. Surely Thomas Stone sensed some disturbance in the universe, and that is why he appeared in our theater. I confess, when I didn't know who he was, I felt nothing. No aura, no tingling,
Nothing other than pride in the miracle Deepak had performed with PVC tube and the uncommon skill in his hands, a skill that the stranger appreciated. When I learned our visitor was Thomas Stone, I was unprepared. Should my first reaction have been anger? Righteousness? I had missed my chance to react while he was there. But now, for the first time since childhood, I wanted to do more than study his nine-fingered portrait. I wanted to know about the living, breathing surgeon who had stood next to me. In the days that followed, I looked up Thomas Stone in Index Medicus in our library, pulling down one by one the oversized volumes beginning with 1954, the year of my birth. I wanted to know about the post-short practice Stone. I wanted to see what scholarly contributions he had made after leaving the tropics. Ours was a small library, but Popsy had donated his collection of surgical journals dating back to the 50s. I found most of the papers listed in Index Medicus. In my notebook, I plotted out Thomas Stone's scientific career as reflected in his published work. In America, his interest was liver surgery, and his career was interwoven with the history of transplantation, with the audacious idea of taking an organ from Peter to save the life of Paul. The story began well before Stone, of course, with Sir Peter Medawar and Sir Macfarlane Burnet in the 1940s, who showed us how the immune system recognizes self from foreign tissues and rejects and destroys the latter. 2 months before our birth, Thomas Stone published a letter to the editor of the British Medical Journal describing the extraordinary length and redundancy of the colon of so many Ethiopians, which he believed explained why it so readily twisted on itself, a condition called sigmoid volvulus. By 1967, when Christian Barnard in Cape Town's Grota Shore Hospital replaced Louis Washkansky's scarred and diseased heart with the heart of young Denise Darvill, killed in a car wreck, my father, now in Boston, had become interested in liver resection. His research question was, how much liver could you cut away and still leave enough behind to sustain life? The transplant field in America was led by a brilliant surgeon, another Thomas, this one with the last name of Starzl. Working in Colorado, Starzl did the first human liver transplants in 63 and 64, but neither patient survived. Thomas Stone of Boston, the footnotes will show, also tried and failed in 65. Despite increasing public criticism, Starzl didn't give up. He performed the first successful liver transplant in 1967. Soon others, Thomas Stone included, managed the same feat. It was still very high risk, but by publishing their experience with such tricks as bypassing portal blood to the superior vena cava during the long surgery, or using the University of Wisconsin solution to better preserve cadaver livers, results were improving. The problem was no longer technical, even though this was the most technically difficult operation anyone could perform. The equivalent of a pianist playing Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme by Paganini, except that one dare not miss a note or fluff a phrase. The operation lasted 10, sometimes 20 hours. Starzl showed it could be done. The two new hurdles were finding sufficient organs to transplant, and of course the problem of rejection of the transplant by the immune system. In 1980, the year of my internship, Starzl turned his attention increasingly to rejection, focusing on a promising new drug that Sir Roy Kalner's group at Cambridge discovered, cyclosporin. Thomas Stone took a different approach. He focused on the problem of the shortage of organs and pursued a solution that most others considered a dead end, removing part of a liver from a living, healthy parent and giving that to a child whose liver was failing. At least in dogs, he found the liver grew in size to compensate for its loss, while the transplanted segment of liver sustained the recipient. But splitting the donor's liver introduced complications, such as bile leaks and clots in the hepatic artery that feeds the liver. It also put a healthy donor's life in real jeopardy, as the liver, unlike the kidney, is unpaired. Even more promising and immediately useful were Stone's work using animal liver cells, trying to strip the cells of those surface antigens which made human cells recognize them as foreign, and then grow them in sheets on a membrane and use them as a sort of artificial liver, a dialysis type of solution. As I read about transplants, I was excited. It was clearly one of the most compelling stories in American medicine. Junior was the center of attention in our ICU. He was deeply sedated, eyeballs roving under closed lids. The kind of trauma he'd been through resulted in shocked lung, or Da Nang lung, recognized in GIs who were resuscitated on the battlefield only to develop this strange lung stiffness, along with kidney shutdown. According to B.C. Gandhi's rules, if you had more than 7 tubes in you, you were as good as dead. Junior had 9. But one by one, over the weeks, the tubes came out and he got better. It required meticulous nursing care, and Deepak and me poring over his daily flowcharts, anticipating his needs and intervening with ongoing problems. J.R., as his family called him, left the ICU for a regular room after 43 days. A week later, smiling sheepishly, he walked out on his own steam with the ICU and trauma teams lined up on either side of the hospital entrance to cheer. If he'd shot someone, the witnesses had all vanished, and the police had lost interest, so J.R. was going home. I think it was the sight of J.R. walking out of the hospital that set me on a course as a trauma surgeon. His kind of recovery was by no means a rule in trauma surgery, but it happened often enough, particularly in those who were young and previously healthy, that it made the heroic efforts worthwhile. The mind was fragile, fickle, but the human body was resilient. As interns, we were allowed to attend one national conference, all expenses paid. I chose a liver transplant conference in May in Boston. I arrived on a lovely spring day. Boston's downtown fit every notion I had of what colonial America was like, and it felt steeped in history, completely different from my section of the Bronx. I told myself that it was coincidence that the conference was in Boston, walking distance from where Thomas Stone worked. I told myself I wasn't there to meet Thomas Stone, but to hear the keynote speaker, Thomas Starzl. As for Thomas Stone's plenary session, I was undecided about attending. The morning of the conference, I could no longer lie to myself. I skipped the transplant meeting and walked the 6 blocks to the hospital in which Thomas Stone had worked all these years. After wearing scrubs for almost a year, my suit and tie felt strange, as if I were in fancy dress. "Send them to Mecca," was an expression we used when we dispatched patients to places that offered what Our Lady of Perpetual Succor could not. It was a common medical expression in hospitals all over America when sending patients to any of the top referral places in the country. I'd even seen it in letters to the editor in the medical journals. Now I was going to Mecca. Mecca consisted of a spanking new hospital tower, weirdly shaped and shining as if it were made of platinum. It was the kind of structure architects compete to build. From a patient's perspective, it didn't look welcoming. The tower hid the older brick sections of the hospital, whose architecture felt authentic and aligned with the neighborhood. "Good morning, sir," a young man in a purple jacket said to me. I glared at him, thinking he was being sarcastic. Then I realized that he and 2 others stood there ready to park cars and assist patients into wheelchairs. The revolving doors led to a glass-walled atrium, the ceiling extending up at least 3 stories and accommodating a real tree. A grand piano played itself by some mysterious mechanism. Around it were plush leather chairs, lamps. Beyond this was a waterfall trickling gently over a slab of granite. Then a reception desk where a concierge, 1 of 3, looked up, smiling, eager to help. I followed the blue line on the floor to the elevators of Tower A, which took me to the Department of Surgery on the 18th floor, just as she said it would, but I made no promise about having a nice day. I found it difficult to believe I was in a hospital. When I emerged from the elevators, I was met by 5 men and 1 woman of my age, all dressed in dark suits, chests labeled with visitor tags exactly like mine.
"We're supposed to wait here," the woman said to me, helpfully.
Just then, a young man, a white coat covering his blue scrubs, approached.
"Sorry I'm late," he said, not sounding sorry at all. "Welcome to the Department of Surgery. My name's Matthew," he grinned at us. God, a year ago I was in your shoes, interviewing for my internship. Time flies. Love the suits. Okay, we have about 20 minutes before Morbidity and Mortality Conference. I'll give you a quick tour of the Department of Surgery. After M&M, you'll have lunch with the house staff, then your individual interviews begin, and then the grand tour of the hospital. When I get you to the conference room, I'll break off. One of my patients is being presented at M&M. I have to go strap on the body armor.
In the year I'd been at Our Lady of Perpetual Succor, I had yet to take any potential intern recruits around. Indeed, I'd never seen anyone come to be interviewed. At Mecca, this was a weekly event. I tagged along. The individual on-call rooms had a television on the wall, a fridge, a nice desk, and an attached bathroom. It was a far cry from Our Lady's solitary on-call room, crammed with bunk beds, with just one phone and interns from all the specialties expected to bed there. I never used it. Next, Matthew showed us the small conference room where the Mecca surgical team held their morning report. It looked like a corporate boardroom with high-backed leather chairs around a long table. Oil portraits of the past chairmen of surgery stared down from the walls. A who's who of surgery.
"Check this out," Matthew said, pushing a button.
Screens came down behind the curtains to black out the room, and a projector rose out of what I took to be a coffee table. Constance, the woman in our group, rolled her eyes as if she thought this was so gauche. When we arrived at the auditorium where Morbidity and Mortality Conference was to be held, Matthew excused himself.
"I have to change out of scrubs. Dr. Stone is a stickler for that. He doesn't even like scrubs on rounds."
The auditorium was a small version of the Cinema Adwa in Addis, only with better seats, upholstered in a nubby beige fabric that felt smooth to the touch. A steep incline made the view from the back excellent, and this is where we prospective interns sat. A bank of motorized X-ray viewing panels was built into one side of the wall behind the podium. A resident stood loading films, stepping on a pedal to advance panels. Constance sat next to me. A gaggle of medical students in short white coats filed in and joined us in the back. I'd forgotten about the existence of medical students. How nice it would be at Our Lady of Perpetual Succor to have someone below me on the food chain. The residents wore longer coats, and their expressions were not as carefree as the students. The attending physicians wore the longest coats and were the last to come in. We interviewees in our dark suits stood out like penguins at a polar bear convention. In all my time at Our Lady, we never had this kind of an assembly. Deepak got us together regularly for coaching sessions, but one sensed a tradition in this room, a way of doing things that had not changed for decades.
"So what school are you from?" Constance asked.
I'd overheard her say she trained in Boston, but it wasn't at this institution. "I went to a school in Ethiopia," I said. If she could have moved one seat over, she probably would have. Thomas Stone didn't look at the crowd when he walked in. He assumed their presence. He was taller than I'd realized from seeing him in the theater, almost as tall as Shiva or me. The room turned quiet. His hands were in the pockets of his white coat. The way he slid into his seat, the ease and fluidity of that motion reminded me of Shiva. He was alone in the front row. I was well behind him, but off to one side, so I could see his profile. This was my first good look at my father. I felt my body grow warm, It wasn't possible to study him dispassionately, clinically. My mind was racing, my heart pounding. I worried that I was giving away my presence. I looked away to try and calm down. When I looked back, Stone was studying a paper in his hand. It was hard to tell he was missing a finger. His hair was quite grey at the temples, but still dark brown on top. His masseter muscles stood out, outlining his jaw, as if he habitually clenched his teeth. The one eye socket that I could see was a recessed dark hollow on his face. I noticed that he kept his head exceptionally still. I can't tell you much about the case being discussed or exactly what transpired. While I looked at Thomas Stone and sat next to the supercilious Constance, a slow fuse burned inside me, and it was about to ignite. I was ready to hurl furniture, activate the ceiling sprinklers, scream obscenities, and disrupt this orderly meeting. I felt an impending loss of control. At one point, I had to grab the arms of my chair as my rage peaked, and then gradually subsided.
"It was my fault," Thomas Stone said, turning to face me.
For a moment, I thought he was clairvoyant. He had heard me. Earlier, Matthew, our escort and the presenter of the case, came under harsh criticism from different quarters of the room. Matthew was only the messenger, but since his attending physician and the chief resident didn't come to his defense, he took the brunt of the attack. The snapping jaws were silenced when Thomas Stone stood up.
"Yes, it was my fault. Without a doubt, we can do better surgically. I am installing a video camera in the two trauma bays. I want us to review the video after every major trauma that comes in. Were we standing in the right place? Did we take 3 steps to reach for an endotracheal tube when it should have been at hand? Did someone have to ask for something that should have been there? Did we distract each other with what we said? Who didn't need to be there? Is there a better way?" That is always the challenge.
He pulled out a piece of paper from his pocket and unfolded it.
"I take responsibility also for something addressed in this letter."
His accent was faintly British, the ears in America having softened it, but without accruing any jarring American inflections. The day he spoke to Deepak over my shoulder in the operating room at Our Lady, I hadn't registered a particular accent.
"This letter came to me from the deceased patient's mother. I want to make sure that this does not happen again. Here is what she says. Dr. Stone, my son's terrible death is not something I will ever get over, but perhaps in time it will be less painful. But I cannot get over one image. A last image that could have been different. Before I was asked to leave the room in a very rough manner, I must tell you that I saw my son was terrified, and there was no one who addressed his fear. The only person who tried was a nurse. She held my son's hand and said, 'Don't worry, it will be all right.' Everyone else ignored him. Sure, the doctors were busy with his body. It would have been merciful if he had been unconscious. They had important things to do. They cared only about his chest and belly, not about the little boy who was in fear. Yes, he was a man, but at such a vulnerable moment he was reduced to a little boy. I saw no sign of the slightest bit of human kindness. My son and I were irritants. Your team would have preferred for me to be gone and for him to be quiet. Eventually, they got their wish. Dr. Stone, as head of surgery, perhaps as a parent yourself, do you not feel some obligation to have your staff comfort the patient? Would the patient not be better off with less anxiety, less fright? My son's last conscious memory will be of people ignoring him. My last memory of him will be of my little boy, watching in terror as his mother is escorted out of the room. It is the graven image I will carry to my own deathbed. The fact that people were attentive to his body does not compensate for their ignoring his being."
Thomas Stone folded the letter and put it away in his breast pocket. There was a rustle in the auditorium, a murmur, an uncomfortable shifting of body weight. I sensed a willingness in the room to shrug off the letter, to scoff at what it said, but Stone's demeanor made it necessary to conceal that urge. Stone stood there, silent, looking out, as if considering the letter's context himself, unaware of his audience. No one spoke. As the moment stretched on, even the smallest noises were stilled until there was only the hum of the air conditioning. Thomas Stone's expression was reflective, certainly not angry. Now, as if waking up, he searched the room for a reaction, seeing if the writer struck a chord. The scoffers had reconsidered their position. When Stone finally spoke, it was in a quiet voice that was firm and commanded attention. He asked a question. I knew the answer because it was in his book, a book I'd read carefully and more than once in my voyage out of Ethiopia and during my stay in Kenya.
What treatment in an emergency is administered by ear?
Surely, with about 200 people in the room, at least 50 would know the answer. No one spoke. He waited. The discomfort grew more acute. I could sense constant stiffening next to me. Thomas Stone spread his feet and put his hands behind his back. He appeared willing to stand there all day. He raised his eyebrows, waiting. The students sitting to my left were too scared to blink. Stone looked over to me, surprised to see a response from the row of dark suits. I felt his eyes bore into mine. It was only the second time he registered my being in this world. The first was when I was born. This time, I only had to raise my hand.
Yes, he said. Tell us, please. What treatment in an emergency is administered by ear?
All eyes were on me. I was in no hurry. None at all. Then my sight turned misty as I thought of Ghosh and the sacrifice he'd made for us. Though he died of leukemia, it now felt to me as if he'd given up his life from the time we were infants so that Shiva and I should have ours. When he died, it was as if a second umbilical cord had been severed. I thought of Hema, widowed, now laboring alone with Shiva at Missing, writing to me to say that her heart was breaking not to have me there, and would I forgive her for not giving me the attention and love I deserved. And all through those years, Thomas Stone probably never missed an M&M conference, never had a day of discomfort over Shiva or over me. I thought of Matron, holding Missing together, an active and loving godmother to two boys, an anchor in our lives. And I thought of Gibru, Almaz, and Rosina, who had stepped in to fill the void of this man's absence. How unjust it was that Thomas Stone's reward for his failings, for his selfishness, should be to preside in that chair and command the respect, the awe, and the admiration of the likes of Constance and others in this room. Surely you couldn't be a good doctor and a terrible human being. Surely the laws of man, if not of God, didn't allow it. I met his gaze, and I did not blink. Words of comfort, I said to my father. The intervening years lay compressed between us as if by bookends. The others in the room looked from my face to his, distressed, uncertain if mine was the right answer. But no one else existed for me or for him.
Thank you, he said, his voice altered. Words of comfort.
He left the room, but looked back at me once when he reached the door. I found where he lived by accident. An elegant condominium complex across the river would have been my guess, but at the base of Tower A, I saw a glass door leading to the outside. Across the street was the lobby to another building. I saw Thomas Stone enter and a doorman greet him. I waited. A few minutes later, he emerged without his white coat and with a yellow and black box in his hand, a slide carousel. He was on his way to the transplant conference. I gave him half an hour, and then I went up to the doorman. I flashed my badge. I'm Marion Stone. Dr. Stone forgot some slides he needed for a talk he was giving. He sent me to pick them up. He was about to quiz me, deny me, but then he cocked his head.
You a relative?
I'm his son.
By God, you are,
he said, coming closer to look into my eyes, as if that was where the similarity resided. He beamed as if the news vindicated him, as if it gave Thomas Stone a human dimension, a redeeming quality.
By God, you are!
He slapped his thigh in delight.
And not a word to us all this time.
He never knew till this year, I said, winking.
Joseph and Mary, get out of here.
I smiled and looked at my watch.
You know where it is?
He said.
Fourth floor? 409.
I entered his house using my penknife and the sort of ancillary surgical skills only a B.C. Gandhi can teach you. It was a one-bedroom apartment. The living dining room had nothing to justify that label. A large work table, like a draftsman's desk, occupied most of that area, with two side tables at its ends to form a U. There were papers in neat stacks on the side tables. Sectional bookcases covered three walls and were full of books and papers. They weren't arranged for display, but for access. The coffee pot in the kitchen was collecting dust. The stove appeared never to have been used. A toaster on the counter had a trace of crumbs on the top. The refrigerator held only a carton of orange juice, a stick of butter, and a half loaf of bread. His bedroom was dark, the curtains drawn. There were no books or papers here, only an army cot, a blanket folded neatly at its foot as if he were camping for one night. A single framed snapshot sat on the mantelpiece above the electric fireplace. The airbrush technique of the 1920s gave mother and son alabaster skin. They were posed like Madonna and child. The boy was perhaps three, ensconced in the lap of the woman who must have been my grandmother, a presence in the world I realized I'd never once thought about. Next to the picture was a glass cylinder filled with murky fluid. Closer inspection revealed a human finger floating in the liquid. I had come there wanting to do damage. That picture made me change my mind. Instead, I opened all the kitchen cabinets and left the doors ajar. I pulled down the oven door. I opened both sides of the fridge. I took the top of the juice container. I opened the bathroom cabinets. I unscrewed toothpaste, shampoo, and conditioner, setting the tops carefully alongside the bottles. I opened anything that had a lid or a cover. I left open wardrobe, chest of drawers, filing cabinet, ink bottle, medicine bottles. I opened the windows. In the center of his desk, I placed the bookmark with Sister Mary Joseph Praise's writing on it.
September 19, 1954. The second edition. The packet came addressed to me, but I am sure the publisher meant it for you. Congratulations. Also, I am enclosing a letter to you from me. Please read at once. S.M.J.P.
I felt certain he had the letter my mother referred to. Now, in his home, I asked myself again. Where was it? And what did it say? I was tempted to ransack the place to find it, but that would have spoiled what I had created. I twisted open the formalin bottle, fished out his finger, shook it free of fluid, and put it next to the bookmark. I studied what I'd done. I changed my mind about the finger. I put it back in the formalin bottle, capped it, and took it with me. It was only fair. After all, I'd left him something of mine. I propped the door open on my way out. Chapter 44. Begin at the beginning. It was 2 weeks later on a Sunday that I heard the knock on my door. We had beaten our arch rivals from Coney Island at a limited overs match on their turf, coming away with the inter-hospital cricket trophy. Nesta had taken 6 wickets for 25 runs in a torrid spell of pace bowling, and 4 of those were by